At the time, Freud frequently made allusions indicating that he regarded me as his successor. These hints were embarrassing to me. In the first place, that sort of thing was not in my nature. In the second place, I could not sacrifice my intellectual independence. And in the third place, such luster was highly unwelcome to me, since it would only deflect from my real aims. I was concerned with investigating truth, not with questions of personal prestige. The trip to the United States, which began in Bremen in 1909, lasted for 7 weeks. We were together every day and analyzed each other's dreams. I regarded Freud as an older, more mature, and experienced personality, and felt like a son in that respect. But then something happened which proved to be a severe blow to the whole relationship. Freud had a dream. I would not think it right to air the problem it involved. I interpreted it as best I could, but added that a great deal more could be said about it if he would supply me with some additional details from his private life. Freud's response to these words was a curious look, a look of the utmost suspicion. Then he said, "But I cannot risk my authority." At that moment, he lost it altogether. That sentence burned itself into my memory. And in it, the end of our relationship was already foreshadowed. Freud was placing personal authority over truth. Freud was able to interpret the dreams I was then having only incompletely or not at all. One in particular was important to me, for it led me for the first time to the concept of the collective unconscious, and thus formed a kind of prelude to my book Symbols of Transformation. This was the dream. I was in a house I did not know, which had 2 stories. It was my house. I found myself in the upper story, where there was a kind of salon furnished with fine old pieces in Rococo style. Descending the stairs, I reached the ground floor. There, everything was much older, and I realized that this part of the house must date from about the 15th or 16th century. The furnishings were medieval. I came upon a heavy door and opened it. Beyond it, I discovered a stone stairway that led down into the cellar. Descending again, I found myself in a beautifully vaulted room, which looked exceedingly ancient. I discovered layers of brick among the ordinary stone blocks, and chips of brick in the mortar. As soon as I saw this, I knew that the walls dated from Roman times. My interest by now was intense. I looked more closely at the floor. It was of stone slabs, and in one of these I discovered a ring. When I pulled it, the stone slab lifted, and again I saw a stairway of narrow stone steps leading down into the depths. These two I descended and entered a low cave cut into the rock. Thick dust lay on the floor, and in the dust were scattered bones and broken pottery, like remains of a primitive culture. I discovered 2 human skulls, obviously very old and half disintegrated. Then I awoke. What chiefly interested Freud in this dream were the 2 skulls. He returned to them repeatedly and urged me to find a wish in connection with them. What did I think about these skulls, and whose were they? I knew perfectly well, of course, what he was driving at, that secret death wishes were concealed in the dream. But what does he really expect of me, I thought to myself. Toward whom would I have death wishes? I felt violent resistance to any such interpretation. I also had some intimation of what the dream might really mean, but I did not then trust my own judgment and wanted to hear Freud's opinion. I wanted to learn from him. Therefore, I submitted to his intention and said, "My wife and sister-in-law." And so I told him a lie. It was plain to me that the house represented a kind of image of the psyche, that is to say, of my then state of consciousness, with hitherto unconscious additions. Consciousness was represented by the salon. It had an inhabited atmosphere, in spite of its antiquated style. The ground floor stood for the first level of the unconscious. The deeper I went, the more alien and the darker the scene became. In the cave, I discovered remains of a primitive culture, that is, the world of the primitive man within myself, a world which can scarcely be reached or illuminated by consciousness. The primitive psyche of man borders on the life of the animal soul, just as the caves of prehistoric times were usually inhabited by animals before men laid claim to them. Certain questions have been much on my mind during the days preceding this dream. On what premises is Freudian psychology founded? To what category of human thought does it belong? What is the relationship of its almost exclusive personalism to general historical assumptions? My dream was giving me the answer. It obviously pointed to the foundations of cultural history, a history of successive layers of consciousness. My dream thus constituted a kind of structural diagram of the human psyche. It postulated something of an altogether impersonal nature underlying that psyche. It clicked, as the English have it, and the dream became for me a guiding image which in the days to come was to be corroborated to an extent I could not at first suspect. It was my first inkling of a collective a priori beneath the personal psyche. This I first took to be the traces of earlier modes of functioning. Later, with increasing experience and on the basis of more reliable knowledge, I recognized them as forms of instinct, that is, as archetypes. The dream of the house had a curious effect upon me. It revived my old interest in archaeology. I read like mad and worked with feverish interest through a mountain of mythological material, then through the Gnostic writers, and ended in total confusion. It was as if I were in an imaginary madhouse and were beginning to treat and analyze all the centaurs, nymphs, gods and goddesses as though they were my patients. While thus occupied, I could not help but discover the close relationship between ancient mythology and the psychology of primitive people, and this led me to an intensive study of the latter. Under the impress of Freud's personality, I had, as far as possible, cast aside my own judgments and repressed my criticisms. That was the prerequisite for collaborating with him. But to me it was a profound disappointment that all the efforts of the probing mind had apparently succeeded in finding nothing more in the depths of the psyche than the all too familiar and all too human limitations. I had grown up in the country, among peasants, and what I was unable to learn in the stables, I found out from the Rabelaisian wit and untrammeled fantasies of our peasant folklore. Incest and perversions were not remarkable novelties to me, and did not call for any special explanation. Along with criminality, they formed part of the black lees that spoiled the taste of life by showing me only too plainly the ugliness and meaninglessness of human existence. That cabbages thrive in dung was something I had always taken for granted. In all honesty, I could discover no helpful insight in such knowledge. It's just that all of those people are city folks who know nothing about nature and the human stable, I thought, sick and tired of these ugly matters. One form of life cannot simply be abandoned unless it is exchanged for another. As for a totally rational approach to life, that is, as experience shows, impossible, especially when a person is by nature as unreasonable as a neurotic. I now realized why Freud's personal psychology was of such burning interest to me. I was eager to know the truth about his reasonable solution, and I was prepared to sacrifice a good deal in order to obtain the answer. Now I felt that I was on the track of it. Freud himself had a neurosis, no doubt diagnosable, and one with highly troublesome symptoms, as I discovered on our voyage to America. Of course, he had taught me that everybody is somewhat neurotic, and that we must practice tolerance. But I was not at all inclined to content myself with that. Rather, I wanted to know how one could escape having a neurosis. Apparently, neither Freud nor his disciples could understand what it meant for the theory and practice of psychoanalysis if not even the master could deal with his own neurosis. When, therefore, Freud announced his intention of identifying theory and method and making them into some kind of dogma, I could no longer collaborate with him. There remained no choice for me but to withdraw. When I was working on my book about the libido and approaching the end of the chapter, The Sacrifice, I knew in advance that its publication would cost me my friendship with Freud, for I planned to set down in it my own conception of incest, the decisive transformation of the concept of libido, and various other ideas in which I differed from Freud. To me, incest signified a personal complication only in the rarest cases. Usually, incest has a highly religious aspect, for which reason the incest theme plays a decisive part in almost all cosmogonies and in numerous myths. But Freud clung to the literal interpretation of it and could not grasp the spiritual significance of incest as a symbol. I knew that he would never be able to accept any of my ideas on this subject. Should I keep my thoughts to myself, or should I risk the loss of so important a friendship? At last, I resolved to go ahead with the writing, and it did indeed cost me Freud's friendship. After the break with Freud, all my friends and acquaintances dropped away. My book was declared to be rubbish. I was a mystic, and that settled the matter. But I had foreseen my isolation, and harbored no illusion about the reaction of my so-called friends. That was a point I had thoroughly considered beforehand. I had known that everything was at stake, that I had to take a stand for my convictions. I realized the chapter, The Sacrifice, meant my own sacrifice. Having reached this insight, I was able to write again, even though I knew that my ideas would go uncomprehended. In retrospect, I can say that I alone logically pursued two problems which most interested Freud: the problem of archaic vestiges and that of sexuality. It is a widespread error to imagine that I do not see the value of sexuality. On the contrary, it plays a large part in my psychology as an essential, though not the sole, expression of psychic wholeness. But my main concern had been to investigate, over and above its personal significance and biological function, its spiritual aspect and its numinous meaning, and thus to explain what Freud was so fascinated by but was unable to grasp. Sexuality is of the greatest importance as the expression of the thonic spirit. That spirit is the other face of God, the dark side of the God image. The question of the thonic spirit has occupied me ever since I began to delve into the world of alchemy. Basically, this interest was awakened by that early conversation with Freud when, mystified, I felt how deeply stirred he was by the phenomenon of sexuality. Freud's greatest achievement probably consisted in taking neurotic patients seriously and entering into their peculiar individual psychology. He had the courage to let the case material speak for itself, and in this way was able to penetrate into the real psychology of his patients. He saw with the patient's eyes, so to speak, and so reached a deeper understanding of mental illness than had hitherto been possible. In this respect, he was free of bias and courageous, and succeeded in overcoming a host of prejudices. Like an Old Testament prophet, he undertook to overthrow false gods, to rip the veils away from a mass of dishonesties and hypocrisies, mercilessly exposing the rottenness of the contemporary psyche. He did not falter in the face of the unpopularity such an enterprise entailed. The impetus which he gave our civilization sprang from his discovery of an avenue to the unconscious. By evaluating dreams as the most important source of information concerning the unconscious processes, he gave back to mankind a tool that had seemed irretrievably lost. He demonstrated empirically the presence of an unconscious psyche which had hitherto existed only as a philosophical postulate. Confrontation with the unconscious. After the parting of the ways with Freud, a period of inner uncertainty began for me. It would be no exaggeration to call it a state of disorientation. I felt totally suspended in midair, for I had not yet found my own footing. Above all, I felt it necessary to develop a new attitude toward my patients. I resolved for the present not to bring any theoretical premises to bear upon them, but to wait and see what they would tell of their own accord. My aim became to leave things to chance. The result was that the patients would spontaneously report their dreams and fantasies to me, and I would merely ask, "What occurs to you in connection with that?" Or, "How do you mean that? Where does that come from? What do you think about it?" The interpretations seemed to follow of their own accord from the patient's replies and associations. I avoided all theoretical points of view and simply helped the patients to understand the dream images by themselves, without application of rules and theories. Soon I realized that it was right to take the dreams in this way as the basis of interpretation, for that is how dreams are intended. They are the facts from which we must proceed. About this time, I experienced a moment of unusual clarity, in which I looked back over the way I had traveled so far. I thought, "Now you possess a key to mythology and are free to unlock all the gates of the unconscious psyche." But then something whispered within me, "Why open all the gates?" And promptly the question arose of what, after all, I had accomplished. I had explained the myths of peoples of the past. I had written a book about the hero, the myth in which man had always lived. But in what myth does man live nowadays? In the Christian myth, the answer might be. Do you live in it? I asked myself. To be honest, the answer was no. For me, it is not what I live by. Then do we no longer have any myth? No, evidently we no longer have any myth. But then, what is your myth, the myth in which you live? At this point, the dialogue with myself became uncomfortable, and I stopped thinking. I had reached a dead end. From the beginning, I had conceived my voluntary confrontation with the unconscious as a scientific experiment which I myself was conducting and in whose outcome I was vitally interested. Today, I might equally well say that it was an experiment which was conducted on me. One of the greatest difficulties for me lay in dealing with my negative feelings. I was voluntarily submitting myself to emotions of which I could not really approve, and I was writing down fantasies which often struck me as nonsense, and toward which I had strong resistances. For as long as we do not understand their meaning, such fantasies are a diabolical mixture of the sublime and the ridiculous. It cost me a great deal to undergo them, but I have been challenged by fate. Only by extreme effort was I finally able to escape from the labyrinth. It was during the advent of the year 1913 that I resolved upon the decisive step. I was sitting at my desk once more, thinking over my fears. Then I let them drop. Suddenly, it was as though the ground literally gave way beneath my feet, and I plunged down into dark depths. But then, abruptly, at not too great a depth, I landed on my feet in a soft, sticky mass. I felt great relief, although I was apparently in complete darkness. After a while, my eyes grew accustomed to the gloom. Before me was the entrance to a dark cave, in which stood a dwarf with a leathery skin, as if he were mummified. I squeezed past him through the narrow entrance and waded knee-deep through icy water to the other end of the cave, where on a projecting rock I saw a glowing red crystal. I grasped the stone, lifted it, and discovered a hollow underneath. At first I could make out nothing, but then I saw that there was running water. In it a corpse floated by, a youth with blonde hair and a wound in the head. He was followed by a gigantic black scarab, and then by a red newborn sun rising out of the depths of the water. dazzled by the light, I wanted to replace the stone upon the opening, but then a fluid welled out. It was blood. A thick jet of it leapt up, and I felt nauseated. It seemed to me that the blood continued to spurt for an unendurably long time. At last, it ceased, and the vision came to an end. I was stunned by this vision. I realized, of course, that it was a hero and solar myth, a drama of death and renewal, the rebirth symbolized by the Egyptian scarab. At the end, the dawn of the new day should have followed, but instead came the intolerable outpouring of blood, an altogether abnormal phenomenon, so it seemed to me. 6 days later, I had the following dream. I was with an unknown brown-skinned man in a lonely rocky mountain landscape. It was before dawn. The eastern sky was already bright, and the stars were fading. Then I heard the horn of Siegfried, the German epic hero, sounding over the mountains, and I knew that we had to kill him. We were armed with rifles and lay in wait for him on a narrow path over the rocks. Then Siegfried appeared high up on the crest of the mountain in the first ray of the rising sun. On a chariot made of the bones of the dead, he drove at furious speed down the precipitous slope. When he turned a corner, we shot at him, and he plunged down, struck dead. Filled with disgust and remorse for having destroyed something so great and beautiful, I turned to flee, impelled by the fear that the murder might be discovered. But a tremendous downfall of rain began, and I knew that it would wipe out all traces of the dead. I had escaped the danger of discovery. Life could go on, but an unbearable feeling of guilt remained. When I awoke from the dream, I turned it over in my mind. You must understand the dream, and must do so at once. The inner urgency mounted until the terrible moment when the voice said, "If you do not understand the dream, you must shoot yourself." In the drawer of my night table lay a loaded revolver, and I became frightened. Then I began pondering once again, and suddenly the meaning of the dream dawned on me. Siegfried, I thought, represents what the Germans want to achieve. Heroically to impose their will, have their own way. I had wanted to do the same, but now that was no longer possible. The dream showed that the attitude no longer suited me. Therefore, it had to be killed. My heroic idealism had to be abandoned, for there are higher things than the ego's will, and to these one must bow. I began to understand that the goal of psychic development is the self. There is no linear evolution. There is only a circumambulation of the self. Some years later, in 1927, I obtained confirmation of my ideas about the center and the self by way of a dream. I found myself in a dirty, sooty city. It was night and winter and raining. I was in Liverpool. The various quarters of the city were arranged radically around the square. In the center was a round pool, and in the middle of it a small island. On it stood a single tree, a magnolia, in a shower of reddish blossoms. It was as though the tree stood in the sunlight and was at the same time the source of light. This dream represented my situation at the time. Everything was extremely unpleasant, black and opaque, just as I felt then, but I had a vision of unearthly beauty, and that was why I was able to live at all. Liverpool is the pool of life. The liver, according to an old view, is the seat of life. I saw that here the goal had been revealed. One could not go beyond the center. The center is the goal, and everything is directed toward that center. Through this dream, I understood that the self is the principle and archetype of orientation and meaning. Without such a vision, I might perhaps have lost my orientation and been compelled to abandon my undertaking. But here, the meaning had been made clear. When I parted from Freud, I knew that I was plunging into the unknown. Beyond Freud, after all, I knew nothing. But I had taken the step into darkness. When that happens, and then such a dream comes, one feels it as an act of grace. The years when I was pursuing my inner images were the most important in my life. In them, everything essential was decided. It was the prima materia for a lifetime's work. The work. As my life entered its second half, I was already embarked on the confrontation with the contents of the unconscious. My work on this was an extremely long, drawn-out affair, and it was only after some 20 years of it that I reached some degree of understanding of my fantasies. First, I had to find evidence for the historical prefigurations of my inner experiences. That is to say, I had to ask myself, where have my particular premises already occurred in history? If I had not succeeded in finding such evidence, I would never have been able to substantiate my ideas. Therefore, my encounter with alchemy was decisive for me, as it provided me with the historical basis I had hitherto lacked. Analytical psychology coincided in a most curious way with alchemy. The experiences of the alchemists were, in a sense, my experiences, and their world was my world. This was, of course, a momentous discovery. I had stumbled upon the historical counterpart of my psychology of the unconscious. The possibility of a comparison with alchemy and the uninterrupted intellectual chain back to Gnosticism gave substance to my psychology. When I pored over these old texts, everything fell into place. The fantasy images, the empirical material I had gathered in my practice, and the conclusions I had drawn from it. I now began to understand what these psychic contents meant when seen in historical perspective. My understanding of their typical character, which had already begun with my investigation of myths, were deepened. The primordial images and the nature of the archetype took a central place in my researches, and it became clear to me that without history, there can be no psychology, and certainly no psychology of the unconscious. I had a starting point in my intense preoccupation with the images of my own unconscious. This period lasted from 1913 to 1917. Then the stream of fantasies ebbed away. Not until it had subsided, and I was no longer held captive inside the magic mountain, was I able to take an objective view of that whole experience and begin to reflect upon it. The first question I asked myself was, what does one do with the unconscious? Only after I had familiarized myself with alchemy did I realize that the unconscious is a process, and that the psyche is transformed or developed by the relationship of the ego to the contents of the unconscious. In individual cases, that transformation can be read from dreams and fantasies. In collective life, it has left its deposit principally in the various religious systems and their changing symbols. Through the study of these collective transformation processes and through understanding of alchemical symbolism, I arrived at the central concept of my psychology, the process of individuation. An essential aspect of my work is that it soon began to touch on the question of one's view of the world and the relations between psychology and religion. I went into these matters in detail first in Psychology and Religion, published in 1938, and then, as a direct offshoot of this, in Paracelsica, published in 1942. Through Paracelsus, I was finally led to discuss the nature of alchemy in relation to religion and psychology, or to put it another way, of alchemy as a form of religious philosophy. This I did in Psychology and Alchemy, published in 1944. Thus I had at last reached the ground which underlay my own experiences of the early years, for the process through which I had passed at that time corresponded to the process of alchemical transformation discussed in that book. It is only natural that I should constantly have revolved in my mind the question of the relationship of the symbolism of the unconscious to Christianity, as well as other religions. Not only do I leave the door open for the Christian message, but I consider it of central importance for Western man. It needs, however, to be seen in a new light, in accordance with the changes wrought by the contemporary spirit. Otherwise, it stands apart from the times and has no effect on man's wholeness. I have endeavored to show this in my writings. I have given a psychological interpretation of the dogma of the Trinity and of the text of the Mass, which, moreover, I compared with the visions described by a third-century alchemist and Gnostic. My attempt to bring analytical psychology into relation with Christianity ultimately led to the question of Christ as a psychological figure. As early as 1944, in Psychology and Alchemy, I had been able to demonstrate the parallelism between the Christ figure and the central concept of the alchemists, the lapis, or stone. The green gold is the living quality which the alchemists saw not only in man, but also in inorganic matter. It is an expression of the life spirit who animates the whole cosmos. This spirit has poured himself out into everything, even into inorganic matter. He is present in metal and stone. My vision was thus a union of the Christ image with his analog in matter. If I had not been so struck by the greenish gold, I would have been tempted to assume that something essential was missing from my Christian view. In other words, that my traditional Christ image was somehow inadequate, and that I still had to catch up with part of the Christian development. The emphasis on the metal, however, showed me the undisguised alchemical conception of Christ as a union of spiritually alive and physically dead matter. This investigation was rounded out by the Mysterium Conjunctionis, in which I once again took up the problem of the transference, but primarily followed my original intention of representing the whole range of alchemy as a kind of psychology of alchemy, or as an alchemical basis for depth psychology. In Mysterium Conjunctionis, my psychology was at last given its place in reality and established upon its historical foundations. Thus my task was finished, my work done, and now it can stand. The moment I touched bottom, I reached the bounds of scientific understanding, the transcendental, the nature of the archetype per se, concerning which no further scientific statements can be made. The survey I have given here of my work is, of course, only a brief summary. I really ought to say a great deal more, or a great deal less. The work is the expression of my inner development, for commitment to the contents of the unconscious forms the man and produces his transformations. My works can be regarded as stations along my life's way. I have never counted upon any strong response, any powerful resonance to my writings. They represent a compensation for our times, and I have been impelled to say what no one wants to hear. For that reason, and especially at the beginning, I often felt forlorn. I knew that what I said would be unwelcome, for it is difficult for people of our time to accept the counterweight to the conscious world. Today, I can say that it is truly astonishing that I have had as much success as been accorded me, far more than I ever could have expected. I have the feeling that I have done all that it was possible for me to do. Without a doubt, that life work could have been larger and could have been done better, but more was not within my power. Retrospect. I am satisfied with the course my life has taken. It has been bountiful and has given me a great deal. How could I ever have expected so much? Nothing but unexpected things kept happening to me. Much might have been different if I myself had been different. But it was as it had to be, for all came about because I am as I am. Many things worked out as I planned them to, but that did not always prove of benefit to me. But almost everything developed naturally and by destiny. I regret many follies which sprang from my obstinacy, but without that trait I would not have reached my goal, and so I am disappointed and not disappointed. I am disappointed with people and disappointed with myself. I have learned amazing things from people and have accomplished more than I expected of myself. I cannot form any final judgment, because the phenomenon of life and the phenomenon of man are too vast. The older I have become, the less I have understood or had insight into or known about myself. I am astonished, disappointed, pleased with myself. I am distressed, depressed, rapturous. I am all these things at once and cannot add up the sum. I am incapable of determining ultimate worth or worthlessness. I have no judgment about myself and my life. There is nothing I am quite sure about. I have no definite convictions, not about anything, really. I know only that I was born and exist, and it seems to me that I have been carried along. I exist on the foundation of something I do not know. In spite of all uncertainties, I feel a solidity underlying all existence and a continuity in my mode of being. The world into which we are born is brutal and cruel, and at the same time of divine beauty. Which element we think outweighs the other, whether meaninglessness or meaning, is a matter of temperament. If meaninglessness were absolutely preponderant, the meaningfulness of life would vanish to an increasing degree with each step in our development. But that is, or seems to me, not the case. Probably, as in all metaphysical questions, both are true. Life is, or has, meaning and meaninglessness. I cherish the anxious hope that meaning will preponderate and win the battle. When Lao Tzu says, "All are clear, I alone am clouded," he is expressing what I now feel in advanced old age. Lao Tzu is the example of a man with superior insight who has seen and experienced worth and worthlessness, and who at the end of his life desires to return to his own being, into the eternal, unknowable meaning. The archetype of the old man who has seen enough is eternally true. At every level of intelligence this type appears, and its lineaments are always the same, whether it be an old peasant or a great philosopher like Lao Tzu. This is old age and a limitation. Yet there is so much that fills me. Plants, animals, clouds, day and night, and the eternal in man. The more uncertain I have felt about myself, the more there has grown up in me a feeling of kinship with all things. In fact, it seems to me as if that alienation which so long separated me from the world has become transferred into my own inner world and has revealed to me an unexpected unfamiliarity with myself.